You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. I hope that you had a great week, and I am so excited for this episode. On October 29th of 2013, I watched a 2020 episode with Barbara Walters and became instantly obsessed. It's one of those stories where you don't forget about it. She interviewed a man named Paul Fronczak who was looking for his true identity. And the story was wild. In fact, last year I tried to track him down to ask him to come on the show. And he said, there are some things that are coming into fruition with the investigation. I can circle back later. So then I see CNN was doing an original documentaries about a story called The Lost Sons. I saw that on a Friday and then tracked him back down and said, you must come on to the show and talk to me. So that aired on Sunday night. You can watch it on demand. And I'm telling you, this is one of the craziest stories and you have got to watch the documentary. And I want to give you some background if you haven't watched already. So on the morning of April 27th, 1964, Dora and Chester Fronczak's new baby boy, Paul Joseph, was just over a day old when a woman dressed as a nurse said he needed to be returned to the nursery for testing. So she took the baby into her arms, she walked out of the room and left Michael Reese Hospital. The hospital didn't notify the authorities or the baby's parents until that afternoon as they scrambled to find the baby. By 3 p.m., they called the father, Chester, at the factory where he worked as a machinist and said, your baby is missing. The infant's abduction sparked the nation's largest manhunt to date, with 200 police officers going door to door around Chicago with a sketch of a mysterious woman. According to the Associated Press, police at the time said blood type and ear shape were about the only leads they had because the boy had no blemishes or birthmarks. Some 10,000 babies were examined and tested by 1966 to see if he could be the boy. Well, after the kidnapping, Dora and Chester stayed in hospital for a week waiting for news. And when they returned home, they were hounded by the press. And despite all the publicity, there were no credible leads and their baby had disappeared without a trace. And that investigation was quietly shelved. But in March of 1966, nearly 2 years later, Dora and Chester received a letter from the FBI. A toddler had been found in Newark, New Jersey, who matched their son's description. The boy had been abandoned in a stroller in a busy shopping center the previous July and had been placed with a foster family named the Eckerts. And they had baptized him Scott McKinley and were so fond of him that they were considering adopting him. But before they could, however, a New Jersey police detective had the idea that that boy might be the missing baby from Chicago. So the FBI began to test that hunch. And there wasn't much to go on because there was no record of Paul Joseph's blood type, nor had the hospital taken the baby's fingerprints or footprints. So all they had was a single photograph taken on the day he was born, and the shape of the baby's ear in that picture was very similar to that of the abandoned toddler. So they ended up testing over 10,000 boys that could possibly be Paul, and he was the only one they couldn't fully exclude. So the Fronczaks are elated to hear the news. And this is back when the FBI was the elite authority. And when they tell you something, you believe it. So 3 months later, they drove from Chicago to meet the boy who might be their son in the offices of the New Jersey Children's Services. All three had been put through a series of psychological tests before the meeting. And Dora and Chester also had to be approved to adopt the child now officially known as Scott. So an FBI agent walked with them in and let them get acquainted for a while with the little boy. And even though they had spent less than a day with the boy before he was taken out of the hospital, and then years later, she felt like this was her child. So the mother, Dora, had since told Paul that she felt like the world was watching her in that moment because there are news cameras watching this young couple with their baby or this little boy that was found. So she could either say, I'm not sure, and put this child back into the system, or say, yes, that's my son. And even if that was not the case, save this child from what could be a horrible life. So she says it's her son. She did what she thought was right. And of course, now he's glad that she did it because he had a great childhood. So they took him to Chicago. They formally adopt him. Paul, as he's now known, grew up in Oak Lawn, Illinois, and attended Catholic schools. He was 10 years old when he went hunting for Christmas presents in his parents' basement. And by the way, I used to do that too. I found a lot of family secrets by snooping around my mom's closet. So you can imagine this 10-year-old, he went hunting for Christmas presents in this little crawl space. He pushes aside a sofa to get into the crawl space, and there he discovers three mysterious boxes full of letters, sympathy cards, and newspaper clippings. One headline read, 200 search for stolen baby. Another said, mother asked kidnapper to return baby. And he recognized his parents in the pictures, looking distraught and much younger. And then he read that their baby son, Paul Joseph, had been kidnapped. So he's excited about this discovery, runs upstairs with a handful of clippings and asks his mother if they were about him. And she obviously reacts not well. And she says to him in that moment, yes, you were kidnapped. We found you. We love you. That's all you need to know. So he knew not to bring up the subject again, and he didn't for like another 40 years. But his curiosity was not satisfied, and often when he was alone in the house, he would sneak back into the crawl space to read more. So after graduating from high school, he leaves home to be a bass player with a rock band in Arizona. 5 years later, when the band breaks up, he returns to Chicago, but soon got restless and joined the Army for a year. And then afterwards, he moved around, working as a salesman and later as a model and an actor. He actually was a stand-in for George Clooney. And so eventually he settles in Las Vegas, and no matter where he moved, he brought along all of those newspaper clippings. In 2008, he gets married for the second time, and he and his wife, Michelle, expect a daughter. And he's so excited, but when the obstetrician asked about the family's medical histories, it hits Paul that he wasn't really sure how to answer. So ever since finding out about the kidnapping, he had wondered if he was really his parents' son. Because what were the chances of him being the one baby taken from Chicago? And also, he didn't look anything like his brother. His brother had all the mannerisms, talked just like their father, and he looked so much different from everybody else in the family. So now the question began to haunt him. Was he really the stolen baby? So for years, he'd wanted to do a DNA test with his parents, not because he wasn't happy with his parents or his life, but he just wanted to know the truth. So he had always found a reason not to do it, and he didn't want to hurt them, but there came a point to where he just needed to know. So one day in 2012, he spots an over-the-counter DNA kit for sale and bought some, because at that point, they had actually become affordable. Before that, they were so expensive. So his parents come over from Chicago for a visit, and he plucked up the courage to broach the subject about an hour before they were about to leave. You know, he's like, have you ever wondered if I'm really your son? And so caught by surprise, his parents admitted that they had. And he said, would you like to find out? So minutes later, everyone swabs their cheeks, the kits are sealed, and then he takes his parents to the airport. But by the time their plane lands a few hours later, they change their minds, they call Paul, and they say, please don't send the kits away. You're our son, and that's the end of it. So he keeps those samples in his desk drawer for a couple of weeks. He's wrestling with that idea every day. Like, I love my parents, I want to respect their wishes, but sometimes you just have to do what you feel is right. And how can you be wrong trying to find the truth? So he sends the samples off and he's at work when he gets a phone call for the results. So after answering some security questions, he's told there was no remote possibility that he was Paul Fronczak, Dora and Chester's biological son. So basically his life as he knew it, he felt ended in that moment. He had the color drains from his face and he couldn't think and all he could do was just sweat and breathe heavily. So everything he knew about himself, his birthday, medical history, being Polish, being Catholic, everything went out the window, and for that second, he didn't even know who he was. So the results raised two urgent questions. One, who were Paul's parents, if not Dora and Chester Fronczak? What happened to the real Paul Fronczak? And before he had even told his parents the news, Paul called a local investigative journalist named George Knapp to ask for help. So soon, Paul Joseph Fronczak was a national news story once again. And his family, who had shunned the media, obviously because it had been a traumatic experience, were furious and didn't speak to him for over a year. So, you know, even though they're these wonderful parents, as you can imagine, they're grappling with, our story is now back in the news, and we don't want our son to be taken away from us, maybe not physically, but emotionally. So one consequence of going public was that the FBI reopens the Fronczak kidnapping case, and they had located 10 boxes full of original case files in Chicago. But because the DNA results proved that he was not the stolen baby, Paul had no right to see any of it. He did, however, speak to one of the retired FBI agents who worked on the original case, Bernie Carey, who admitted that some of the team had not been convinced that they had found the right child. Paul had more luck with the search for his own biological parents. So a team of volunteers called the DNA detectives. Now, you're going to recognize her name. It's led by genetic genealogist Cece Moore, who has been a guest on my show. She's incredible. They used a combination of DNA testing and classic investigation techniques, so searching newspapers and public records, trawling through social media, and endless phone interviews. And although Paul had been found in New Jersey, they traced his family to Tennessee. And meanwhile, his DNA test had revealed that he was an Ashkenazi Jew. So raised in a Polish Catholic household and then finds out he has Ashkenazi Jewish roots. So, I mean, can you only imagine? It's just like a whirl of emotions. Like, so on June 3rd of 2015, 2 years after they had begun their investigation, they spoke to Paul on the phone. So 2 years of investigations, and Cece Moore calls Paul and she says, "What do you think of the name Jack?" And he's like, "I like it. It's a strong name. It's a good name." And she says, "Well, that's your name. You were born Jack Rosenthal and you're 6 months older than you think you are. Your actual birth date was October 27th, 1963. So his real name is Jack Rosenthal. He's 6 months older than he thought he was. But here's the kicker. He had a twin sister named Jill. And like him, she had vanished. So now there's another person for Paul to find. So where is the real Paul Fronczak? Why was Jack Rosenthal dropped in a stroller and abandoned in front of a department store? And where is his twin sister? So the documentary reveals all of the unraveling of the story and tracking down the relatives of the Rosenthals. Now, the real Paul Fronczak, it's a man who lived in a tiny town of Mant, Michigan, and he was identified as Paul Joseph Fronczak. The baby was kidnapped from his mother's hospital room. And his name is Kevin Beatty. He was a machinist and mold maker who grew up in Manton, a town of about 1,200 people or so in Wexford County, 10 miles north of Cadillac. And he was in his mid-50s in late 2018, still living in the Manton area when he learned that the only name he'd ever known was not actually his first. He was actually born on April 25th, 2020, a year and a half after learning his true identity. And his name was Kevin Beatty, as mentioned, but here's the crazy thing. Kevin's real birth date was April 25th. That's when Dora gave birth to him. He died on April 25th. He thought his real birthday was March 14th because he was kidnapped and taken and lived with another set of parents. And they told him, "Your birthday is March 14th. So he was actually a month younger than his true birth date. And then he ultimately ended up dying on his own true birth date, the birth date of the real Paul Fronczak. So real Paul Fronczak was taken and ended up living with a couple who lived in Michigan, not too far away, and was an only child. And he found out shortly before he died of cancer that he was the real Paul Fronczak. So this story is just nutty, right? So it's The Lost Sons on CNN Demand. You can watch it until October 26th. It's a crazy story, but here's the best part. Paul Fronczak is my guest today. I was so excited to talk to him, and I'm sure I'm going to continue to talk to him. He's got a book coming out in December with all new updates on the case. And they're still looking for Jill, but I feel like they're getting close. And also in this episode is my friend Brian Moylan, who you guys know wrote the book about Housewives, and he's so darn funny. We talk about the season premiere of Vanderpump Rules. There's a lot to unpack there. So here we go. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KKC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KKC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KKC. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. I feel like for 15 years, I don't even know, I have watched every single show about your story. And then about a year ago, I contacted you and you said, there's some more updates and I'm not ready to talk yet. So when this special came up, I was so excited to watch it, let alone the chance to talk to you. So first of all, I have to welcome you to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a privilege, and thank you very much for your interest.
This is really one of the craziest stories I have ever heard. And you have a great way of storytelling. So the first thing I want to do is just kind of go through the timeline, the sequence of events. Paul Fronczak was born on April 26, 1964, and then kidnapped a day later from Michael Reese Hospital on April 27, 1964. Next thing is that in June of 1965, you're found outside of a department store in Newark. What did they find? Like, tell me about how they found you. Were you in a stroller?
Yeah, I was in a brand new suit in a stroller. I had a black eye and I was sick.
Unbelievable. So then they put you into foster care. And while you're in foster care, they name you Scott. And they had hoped to adopt you. But by then, a police officer assigned to the case remembers this newspaper photo of baby Fronczak and contacts Chicago authorities. The Fronczaks, your parents, were brought to New Jersey to see if they could identify the abandoned boys, their son Paul. They did, and the boy, which was you, was handed over and raised as Paul Fronczak. And no tests were taken, obviously, because it was years ago. And in the special, at the end of it, your mom kind of explains, even though there was this feeling that maybe it wasn't a match, she still proceeded forward. So at this point, Paul Fronczak, the original baby from Michael Reese Hospital, is now living with someone else. You are found outside of a department store. You are brought to Chicago, and then you are raised by the Fronczaks as Paul Fronczak. And you grew up in Oaklawn, Illinois, and you said you always felt like an outsider. And at around the age of 10, you find a box of clippings at which your mother got a little bit agitated and asked you to never talk about it, and you never did. And then you take a DNA swab in 2012 and find out you're absolutely not Paul Fronczak, correct?
Correct. That's a nice job.
So you did this painstaking detective work and a team of genealogists and found relatives on the East Coast. So cousins, uncles, two older siblings. Your biological parents, you learned, were deceased, and that your older biological siblings refused to talk to you. What was that like to get through all of that detective work and then find out that these two siblings were unwilling to talk? Did you take that personally? And did it lead you to believe that the reason they didn't want to talk was because there were too many secrets?
Well, take it personally. It's, you know, pretty much this whole journey has been complete highs and extreme lows. So this fact that someone doesn't want to speak with you, it's just weird, I think. I mean, to me, they're hiding something. Mm-hmm. Because why else? If someone called me and said, "Hey, I'm your brother," I'd be like, "Where are you? I'll be right there." It's a no-brainer. Why would you not want to embrace family unless something is wrong and you know it?
Did they get a chance to see a photo of you or ask for any information about you?
Well, they knew the story from, you know, they were following the story, which I think is interesting. But I was invited into my sister's trailer, hung out for about a half an hour talking. And we made plans to have lunch the next day, and she just didn't answer the door. And then I got an email from my younger brother who said, "I think it's a scam. I want nothing to do with you." And that was it.
How much did you know that they knew about the story beforehand?
I really didn't know how much they knew, because both of them said that they had no idea that they had an older brother and sister, as my younger brother said, or a younger brother and sister, twins, no doubt. You know, it's just this family just made twins just vanish like they never existed.
How many people have you found in their orbit knew about this couple having twins? Not just the babysitter that we get to see in the special, but outside of that, were there any other people in their orbit that knew about the twins?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Aunts and uncles, cousins. A lot of them had actually saw the twins, and not the best circumstances, as I kind of laid out in the first book. Yeah. But the twins existed. We have a newspaper article. I have a birth certificate for both myself and Jill. So yeah, we were there.
Have any of the relatives said you look remarkably like your parents, either your mother or your father?
My cousin Lenny. Unfortunately, he just passed away. And so he was the coolest guy ever. He said, "I was a spitting image of my dad. And my mannerisms, the way I speak, just kind of laid back and just, you know." And him and I just clicked immediately. He said, "I feel like I'm talking with my friend, Gil, you know." It's uncanny.
I mean, you definitely do look like Lenny. And then at the end, when you're playing the guitar and playing music, it was very touching because it did seem like you did remind him of your father. I wondered how much you've learned about your parents. Tell me a little bit about them, your biological parents.
Yeah, I've learned quite a bit about them, and it's nothing really good to say. So, but someone who gets rid of twins, you can do the math on that, right?
Well, I also wondered if they had felt the financial pressure, because at that time, your mother probably didn't have any indication she was having twins to begin with. And at that time, the shock of having twins and then the overwhelming financial responsibility that had to have played into it in some way. Not that that excuses anything, but if we were to try to understand who they were at that time, in the world, did you get any sense from relatives that the financial financial impact of having such a large family had gotten to them?
Well, I had two older sisters and a younger brother. And the younger brother was around when they discarded me and Jill. So is it really finances?
your parents, Dora and Chester, seem like extraordinary people. And we get a chance to see your mom towards the end. Tell me a little bit about them, because they just seem like spectacular people. And obviously, one can understand how they wanted to keep this a secret to protect you and to protect your family. What were they like as parents?
My parents, they're wonderful. I mean, my dad passed away in 2017. My mom is doing fantastic. They're just great people. They were loving. They were caring. They took me in, not really even knowing if I was their son. You know, that right there tells you what kind of people they are. So yeah, I was so lucky that I was tossed out of one family and taken in by the Fronczaks. They saved my life.
What does your brother think about all of this?
Yeah, he was against it for a long time. He just didn't understand why I wanted to do any of this. And I just wanted them to understand that my mom and dad gave me the greatest gift ever of taking me in and raising me. I thought the best thing I could do for them would be to find their kidnapped child. I knew he was out there. I knew he was still alive. And I wasn't going to stop until I found him. So I thought that I could just present him to them and say, thank you for giving me the life that you did. And Dave just didn't see it that way. You know, he kind of sided with my parents for a while there, and just, you know, that I only wanted to find better parents and I wasn't happy with the Fronczaks, which never was the case.
I can't blame you. I feel like I would have left no stone unturned, and I know you continue to do that. And I absolutely understand why you've been on this pursuit for answers, especially knowing that you have a twin sister and that her story needs to be told. And once you heard that you were a twin, was there a part of you that thought, that makes sense? Like, I felt like there was something there, like a connection. Did it feel right to you?
I've always had this yearning that something was missing in my life. That's why I think I just keep changing jobs and locations and people in my life. I think because I had that connection that was taken away. And I think I'm always trying to find it again.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely. So what do you know of, Paul Fronczak, the original Paul Fronczak has since passed away. Do we know any more details about how that kidnapping may have happened? I know that there was a story about Linda Taylor and how she may have been connected to the story. She was the welfare queen. Do we know anything more about the circumstances involving his disappearance?
You know, I'm glad you asked that. I'm actually working on this really, really big lead right now, and I think it's gonna lead us.
Oh, good.
I think we're gonna solve this, and it's gonna be very soon. So I can't say anything now because I've got a couple of sources that if I tell what's happening, they're gonna be scared off. So I'm asking you to stay tuned. I promise when we solve this, I'll do a story with you.
Oh, good. I'm gonna hold you to that.
I knew you would.
I also thought as I watched the documentary, you were raised in a Polish Catholic family. And then what was it like to find out that your name was Jack Rosenthal, that your birth family was Jewish?
Yeah, that was quite a shock. I have to admit that. I've been baptized twice. I was an altar boy growing up. I went to Catholic grammar school and high school. And when I found my real parents' graves, you know, the Jewish star and everything's on the headstones. So I'm going to heaven either way. That's how I take it, you know.
What part of this story as it has unfolded thus far has been the most surprising? That you were a twin?
To be fair, the whole story has been surprising to me. And every time I learn something, just when you think that it can't get any more strange, something else happens. So that's the way this whole journey's been. But yeah, the fact that I was a twin, I mean, that was amazing news. And it just set me on another mission. You know, I thought I'd find Paul, maybe find out who I was. And then all of a sudden, I have a twin. So now I have to find that twin too.
Have you met Paul's three daughters?
I have not.
You mentioned that your obsession was in you blame in part for the breakup of your marriage and the 3-year rift with your adoptive parents. Do you feel like as time goes on, you've been able to heal some of those wounds?
My mom and I, right now, we're in a place that we've never been in our entire lives together. We talk about everything. And I couldn't be more happier. And she actually thanked me for starting this journey. And to me, that is worth everything in my life. And I would do it again and again and again. So yeah, that's that's the reason I started this was for my parents. And my mom got to connect with her real son and got to say goodbye to him before he passed away. So that made everything worthwhile to me. And I have no regrets.
Do you think that maybe some of the other ancillary relatives of your siblings may come forward and give you more details about what may have happened to you as a child and your twin sister?
You know, I really hope so. I've spoken with quite a few of them, and some of them had some really tough accounts of what they witnessed when, you know, we were with the family. So I'm hoping that a neighbor or someone comes forward that actually knows something. And that would be great because I'm not going to stop until I solve this.
At this point, can we still hold out hope that Jill may be alive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Matter of fact, I had a psychic reading and I believe in psychics. And she said that she sees Jill. Yeah, she sees Jill alive and like giving some kind of interview or something. So, I'm not fooling myself. I know that if something terrible did happen, I mean, I've dug a grave before looking for her. And if I can do it again, I'll do it again. But I would much rather find her alive and reconnect with her. That would be the most amazing, amazing day ever.
I am so obsessed with this story and have been for years. But I really think that in the end, that you are spurring conversations with families everywhere, helping people seek answers to their own genealogy, connecting people, but also highlighting security measures in hospitals and also highlighting abuse in the home. And so in the end, I think while this journey has undoubtedly been frustrating and painful at times, that there is some great things that will come out of it.
Hospitals have something called Code Pink. And that was started from the Franzak kidnapping. Whenever there's a threat of a kidnapping in a child ward, maternity ward, hospital goes on lockdown immediately. If they would have had that in place when Paul was taken, Paul would have never gotten away. And so that's a wonderful thing that, and that actually sprung out of the kidnapping itself.
Well, I'm obsessed with the story. I'm going to hold you to it. I'm going to keep following you for updates. The Lost Sons is streaming on CNN. It will be streaming until October 26th. I can't thank you enough. I'm so glad I finally got a chance to talk to you about the case. Where could everybody find you?
Okay, you can find me at foundlingpaul.com or the Facebook page, Who Was Paul Franzak? I've got a new book coming out in December called True Identity. It takes off where the first book, The Foundling, leaves us. So it's continuing that journey. And once again, you're there with me taking that journey. So I hope that you look for that as well. Any questions, tips? Just you want to say hi? Stop by and just say hi.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Brian J. Moylan, you have been writing recaps of Bravo shows, including Vanderpump Rules, for years. This week marked the premiere of the newest season of Vanderpump Rules, and it is a much different version than the one that we've ever seen. I read your recap, and you referred to them as geriatric binge drinkers, and for that, I salute you. Welcome
thank
to the
you,
show.
Thank you.
And also, right out of the gates, what are you thinking about Vanderpump Rules coming back, given so many people have left the team?
I must say, I'm like a little ambivalent about it. It was nice to see the old gang again, especially the Toms, who I love. And I love that we are no longer pretending like anyone has any aspirations of working at Sir other than James and Raquel and Charlie, which is fine. I just feel like the magic is gone a little bit. And I feel like what was great about Vanderpump Rules when it started was you had these deep organic relationships between all these people who were actually friends and who had been working together and sleeping together and cheating on each other and whatever. And now those are all gone. And I feel, And also part of my problem, and I think this might be a Brian problem as opposed to a show problem, is I know what a meddler Lisa Vanderpump is. And so now I don't believe any of the plots on the show are real. I feel like she's kind of making some of it up.
So to your point, there's a scene in the premiere where Max and James have had an altercation and she brings them together in her chalet. And from what we understand, they went to Dan Tana's. There was an argument over splitting a plate, which would be $10 extra. Now, for someone like Max Todd, would a split plate really affect his bottom line? Because I get the sense this guy is living the high life with a condo paid for by Lisa and Ken.
I think you are. I think it seemed like it might be more of the principle where he would have been like, oh, I'm not paying $10 extra just to split a plate because we wouldn't do that, sir. So I sort of get the point because I wouldn't pay $10 to split a plate and I'm doing fine too. But the whole thing just seemed really weird where like Lisa is calling her son and this guy to her house for a summit. But like, why does James have to get along with her son so he can DJ at Sir? Like, she needs him that badly. And then like Max is the one who leaves. It's like, no, it's your mom's house. Like, James should leave.
And do you want to be the mother that's breaking up a fight between two guys in their late 20s/early 30s?
Yeah, no, you don't. I get that we're on a reality show and okay, but the whole thing just seemed like she said to them, okay, you're mad because James is always an asshole and you're going to stay mad and then you're going to tell him he's not welcome at Sir so that over the course of the season, he can make it back up to you. And that's just, I didn't believe that it was an organic thing. And it all made sense. Like the whole argument tracked, but it was just like, I don't buy this.
I also thought, where is the authenticity in terms of acknowledging the crazy world that we were living in at the time they started filming this? So it's just like Lisa Vanderpump with like her pot, her gardening shoes on with a Silver City pink lipstick and just, you know, talking about a fight between sons or her son and his friend when it's like, where's the acknowledgement that you own restaurants? Your business has been decimated. You've had basically no income. You have a staff that have been out of work. Where is the openness?
That she fired.
Yeah, like, where's the openness about, God, the stress level that I've been under, how this has affected my relationships, my mental well-being? Like, it's like they just moved on, like nothing ever happened.
And yeah, Andy said in an interview, Andy Cohen said in an interview that reopening a restaurant during the pandemic is inherently interesting, which I agree with, but we don't see any of it. We see like a small acknowledgement at the beginning when the Toms come back and they're figuring out what they can do with the restaurant. But other than that, we don't see it. We're at, you know, in Sandoval's backyard at some weird party for Sheena's birthday.
Also, they've opened up a new restaurant and they make it seem like Lisa had no idea. And then they just say it like it's no big deal. Like, you're opening a restaurant in a global pandemic when your other restaurant has had zero occupants. Like, what world are we living in?
Absolutely. And right. And there was no discussion of, how are you guys making it through? What are you going to do? What are your plans? Like, I would be more interested in seeing that and seeing them actually struggle with these things than like, I'm Katie and I really want to be involved in this restaurant, which we all know is a bad idea, but also seems like something that they could be like, we're going to pretend like, you know, Katie wants to be involved and then we're going to get in a fight. Like, it seemed very Bethany and Jill season 3, like, we're going to pretend to break up because it'll make great television, you know, because they're the center now, I guess. I don't know.
And this ongoing fighting between Sandoval and Katie. Now, he puts her down, says she's like done nothing during the pandemic, which, by the way, lots of people did nothing. Now, I had one thing that really bothered me is he said, all you did the whole pandemic is play Legos. Now, let me say this. I busted my ass during COVID, homeschooling 4 children, taking care of another one, and with this job. I would have loved to have sat back and done some Legos. So I salute her for that. And number 2, well, what if she was depressed?
Right. Yes.
Well,
that's what's crazy about there's a conversation on Real Housewives of Potomac now about Robin and how she can't get out of bed. It's like, girl, Robin is depressed. Get her some drugs. Like, that's what's going to fix it. But also, I mean, Katie's job is to do nothing. Katie's job is to be on a reality television show.
Correct.
And if they're not filming it, what else is she going to do? Like, get on Instagram and sell flat tummy tea? I don't know.
Okay. So what do you think at this point about the role of Ariana on the show? Because she's pretty open about her hatred of most people, which is hard for me to take if I'm going to spend an hour of my week watching a show that she's on. Because if I know you hate me, why do you want me to watch the show?
Right. I like Ariana, and I always feel like she was the one I would actually be friends with. Like, she seems kind of cool and pretty and, you know, has a good sense of what's going on in the world. But yeah, there was something about her in her fight with Lala in this episode where she just seemed much more performative than she usually would be and much more like, I'm fighting on a reality show than she has been in the past. And I was kind of like, I don't know how I feel about this.
Yeah. And do you believe that they will be together for the rest of time? Or do you feel like this show is what keeps them together?
I feel like he and Ariana and Tom and Katie, yeah, I mean, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce, but it seems like they have a much more authentic relationship than I would say James and Raquel do.
True. So let's talk a little bit about Lala and Sheena as new moms. I kind of feel like it's hard to process those two becoming mothers because we're so used to a show about, to your point, geriatric binge drinkers. So it's almost like we've been watching a show about a bar at 10 p.m. and this show is about the bar that just turned the lights on at the end of the night.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I wrote something for Vulture at the end of last season being like, Vanderpump Rules needs to evolve. And I think that I don't even know that these are some great characters and they're in a great stage of their life, but we started watching a show about messes in their 20s, and they're no longer messes in their 20s. Well, Lala's still in her 20s, but you know, and it's like, they're all married. They're all having kids. They all moved out to what is essentially the suburbs. Like, we need the show to change with them just as we're changing. And it's like, get a new show called Vanderpump Rules about kids fucking around and being drunk in their 20s. But like, let's follow them and watch them become more serious. And instead of trying to recreate that old magic in these parties and whatever, try to find something new to do with them.
I do feel like, and I remember I interviewed Lala about her book, and it was 2 days before they started filming. And then it felt like in a hot minute, they had finished filming. So I feel like the total filming of the season was like 2.5 months, maybe.
Yeah, that seems short.
And you think about people that did not speak to each other at all since the end of the filming of the show, which had been quite some time. Then they're shoved together at a dinner party when they have absolutely nothing in common. They're harboring resentment. They've got cameras in their faces. And then two people are pretty much sober because they have to go home and pump. I don't know if this is the makings of a great show.
No. Well, and James is sober at this point. Like, yeah, it's not Stassi throwing a fit over a birthday party, which... No. Is what we wanted. Yeah. And I think there is an interesting show about people transitioning from their 20s into their 30s and having their first kid and dealing with grown-up relationships and all that. But I don't know that this is that show.
I agree with you. I think if they were all the original players and they were transitioning into that next chapter, that would be interesting. But now it's almost like the seniors have graduated from school. And there's like a fifth year senior, a sophomore that's okay, and then a bunch of freshmen that don't know anything about the people that graduated.
No, what it seems like. It seems like people who have graduated high school and gone to college and come back to high school.
Oh, yeah.
You know what you're right. What's up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, like let Lala graduate. And, you know, one of my ideas was kind of like Housewives Junior, where you have like, Ariana and Katie and Lala and Sheena, like trying to figure out what's next. Like, okay, we're reality famous. Like we're married, we're in relationships. What do we do now? You know, and then bringing them together like you do Housewives, but then also focusing on what they're doing outside the house. But I guess the problem is if you're Katie, you're just working on Legos. I mean, same with Ariana. Ariana didn't do much of anything from what I could tell during the pandemic either. So yeah.
Like I said, I like doing Legos all day. You know, sounds like a goddamn vacation at this point. The last thing I want to ask you about is Sheena's baby daddy, Brock. I was a little bit perplexed because he's participating in confessionals or in the moment interviews, and he's wearing a satin suit with what seems to be a sequin top. Is this somebody who had always dreamed of being on American television and thinks that this is his gateway to success? What's going on here?
I mean, it is interesting. Well, let us not forget that he is Australian and they are basically like Neanderthals. So maybe he just thinks that this is a good outfit. I don't know. But I think that if you're someone, what's interesting about getting in a relationship with Sheena or any of the housewives really is you have to not only sign up to be in a relationship with that person, but to be a public person and to be in a relationship with the show. And so Brock is obviously signed on to do the show. And I'm curious, you know, I want to see a few more episodes, what he behaves like. So far, he wasn't that active in the drama. So we'll see. I'm going to give him a pass for a little bit, but I would err on the side of, yeah, I met a reality star and I'm going to be on the show and now I'm going to be famous. As opposed to someone like Bo, Stassi's boyfriend, who seemed like, okay, I'll do this because you're on it, but I don't really love it.
Yeah. Now, do you think that Jax and Brittany watched this season premiere? And if they did so, was it behind the couches with like, you know, just kind of popping up and then going back down for commercial breaks?
They fucking watched every second of it. They were on Twitter. They were looking at Twitter. Like, I feel like, I've been obsessed with Jill Zarin because I always say that when she got fired, it ruined her life. And I feel the same way about Jax and Brittany. Like, they so identified with the show and being famous and loving that and loving the attention. And especially for Jax, needing that validation from other people. And now that it's been taken away, they're just going to drown themselves in a vat of Meemaw's beer cheese that they never ended up marketing.
Mm. And it does seem like if there's any show, it might be a show that's only about the girls that are actually friends. And I think that has to be, you know, the Lala and the Kristen and the Stassi. And I don't know if people are ready for Stassi to come back, but it seems like that is the most likely successful show because those are organic, real friendships.
Absolutely. And that's why I believe that those fights about, you know, Lala talks shit about me on a podcast and Sheena talks shit about me on her podcast and whatever. Like, that seems like the dynamic of these girls living on the fringes of fame. And so I'm like into hearing about all that more so than I am like, oh, is James going to DJ at Sir? Like, who gives a fuck? James is beyond DJing at Sir at this point. Like, you know, we saw clips from his actual gigs on the show and they're a lot bigger than a shitty Tuesday night at Sir. So, yeah.
Well, I hope that the Institute of Reality Studies listens to this interview and takes us and all of our, you know, great advice as the Bible, and that we get a phone call and get some cut of a forthcoming show. That is my prayer for this world right now.
I hope that comes about too. I will say though, I am very excited for Charlie with an I.
Yeah, but she should not be on the show. She needs to be on a show with her own real friends. And it's about struggling through the process, struggling through auditions. And you have some proximity to fame, but not totally because you've been on the show enough, but struggling to go to different auditions, especially if she lives in some sort of Melrose Place neighborhood, where we're going to see other people that are like struggling hot models and actors post-COVID.
Yes. And she should be on season one of the new Vanderpump Rules, which is exactly the show you were just describing.
We just need to find them.
Like, was the season one of the original Vanderpump Rules, you know? And yeah.
What if they lived in the duplex that Mike from Shaws of Sunset is trying to build, but will never be completed? What if they lived in that duplex as it's still being under construction, and there are four units and Charlie lives in one of them?
I mean, I feel like, did you read those stories about Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard and how they're like apparently these big LA landlords?
I did.
Like, Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard like should sell Bravo or rent Bravo one of their apartment buildings and move a bunch of people in. And it could be like Kristen Bell Rules.
It could be like the Circle Vanderpump Rules kind of crossover mishmash. But to your point, I do think it needs to go back to the original vibration that has seemed to have gone away. Well, tell everybody about your brilliant book that I'm sure they've already purchased and read four times, but if they have not, they were not listening that week and they haven't walked into any Barnes & Noble in the last couple of months, where can they find your book?
You can find my book at thehousewivesbook.com and anywhere books are sold. It's called The Housewives, : The Real Story Behind The Real Housewives. And it's the real story behind The Real Housewives. But so lots of behind the scenes stuff and how it gets made and the history of Bravo and all sorts of juicy details. So go out and get it.
And then you're writing for Vulture, and what else are you working on so they can follow it?
I actually have my first podcast coming out in November.
And it's
called The 12 Gays of Christmas. And I interview gays about their favorite Christmas movies. So our first episode comes out at the beginning of November. And so we're going to do one a week in November and then two a week through December. And we're doing like Gremlins and White Christmas and Home Alone and the Charlie Brown Christmas special and all sorts of different things. So That should be real fun.
Now, will you address on the Home Alone episode that those parents were horrible? I mean, who would get on a plane when they're one of their kids? And when they landed, why didn't, like, I just, anyway, okay.
I haven't recorded that episode yet, but I will bring it up for you. I'll be like, hey, Casey wants us to address the fact that these parents are horrible, even though one of them is Catherine O'Hara, who is a national treasure for Canada.
And should be protected at all costs. But please find somebody who has children so they could riff about that, because in retrospect, it is diabolical. Okay, Brian, thank you as always. I love you to the moon and back.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
I want to thank my amazing guests, Paul and Brian, and remind you to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Guys, I'm approaching my 400th episode. If you would do me the greatest favor and leave me a great review, I would love it. Appreciate it so much. Join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. We can talk about this episode, and please do. Let's get our investigation skills going and help Paul. And you talk about other episodes as well, including my episode this past Wednesday with PK. So make sure you listen to that too. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. You can also see clips from my recent Patreon public episodes about the Gabby Petito case and Brian Laundrie's whereabouts. If you go to Kate Casey CA on Instagram, my Patreon is patreon.com/KateCasey with bonus episodes. Several public, again, as mentioned, about the Gabby Petito case. And you can also find me on TikTok at It's Kate Casey. And lastly, check out my must-watch list every week. You can go to katecasey.substack.com to get that in your inbox every Monday, and I will tell you what to watch each week. I'm hoping that you have a great week, and I can't wait to circle back with you next week. I've got interviews with Mia from Real Housewives of Potomac coming up and Lisa Ling.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.